They weren't going to put up with it. That was what. There was a lot of talk about forming up a mass hike and marching on Dayton, Washington, but who was going to feed the chickens? They resolved to make inventories of all the stuff they still imported from Dayton Earth. Medicines, for one. Books, paper, pens, electronic gadgets, even luxuries like perfumes. By sharing and swapping and mending, maybe they could manage with what they had, until things settled down. The idea was floated of getting together with the neighbors. There was a bunch of nearby settlements spread over a few dozen worlds that some were starting to call New Scarsdale County. They could help each other out in case of scarcities and emergencies. Some spoke of going back. A mother with a diabetic kid. Folk who found that advancing age wasn't mixing well with the hard work of farming. A few who just seemed to feel scared without the backing of the government, however remote it was. But others, like Helen's dad, urged nobody to leave. They all relied on each other. They had put together a spectrum of complementary skills that enabled them to survive if they worked together. They couldn't let the community they'd built be pulled apart. And so on. Rhys Henry let it all ramble on and run down. They broke up without resolution. The next morning, however, the sun rose on schedule, the chickens needed feeding, and the water needed toting from the well. And somehow, life went on. 3 months later, Helen's sister Katie had quietly brought forward her wedding. She and Harry Burgreen had been planning to wait until the following year, when they were hoping for a proper house-raising. Everybody knew that they were getting married now, while Mom was still around to see it. Helen was enough of a girly girl that she had grown up dreaming of fairy-tale princess weddings. Well, this day turned out to be a pioneer's wedding, kind of different, but still fun. The guests had started arriving early, but Katie and Harry and their families were ready to meet them. Bride and groom were dressed in informal clothes, no white gowns or morning suits here, but Katie was wearing a small, pretty veil, made by sister Helen from the lining of an old hiking jumpsuit. As time wore on, people showed up from outside Reboot itself, friends and acquaintances from communities like New Scarsdale, and even further afield. The guests brought gifts, flowers and food for the day, and practical stuff, cutlery, pots, plates, coffee pots, kettles, frying pans, a hearth set, a boot scraper. Some of this stuff had been made locally, pottery cast on Reboot wheels, or iron gadgets hammered out in Reboot forges. It didn't look much, piled up before the Green's big hearth, but Helen realized it soon amounted to pretty much all a young couple would need to equip their first home. Around noon, Rhys Henry arrived, wearing a reasonably smart jacket, clean jeans and boots, and a string tie. He scrubbed up well. Helen knew that nobody in Reboot took Mayor Henry as seriously as he took himself, but still, you needed one individual in a community with the authority to formalize a marriage, an authority backed by some remote government or not, and he played the part well. Plus his hair was magnificent. And when Harry Burgreen kissed his bride, a little after midday, and everybody applauded, and the bride's mother held onto her husband's arm to make sure she stayed standing for the pictures, even Bill the mailman had tears welling in his eyes. "That one was a good day," Helen recorded in her journal. And 3 months later,
"Second baby for Betty Doak Hansen. Healthy B, 7 pounds. Mother ill. Needed stitches and blood."
Helen had been tired. Too tired to write in this damn code in her journal, even if they did have to conserve paper now. This latest delivery hadn't been a bad birth as they went. Belle Doak and her little team of midwives and helpers, including Helen, were pretty competent at it by now. Although this morning it had been a close-run thing. Helen had to run around town asking for blood donors. They were all walking blood banks for the benefit of their neighbors, but it wasn't always fast enough. Memo to self, she thought,
set up some kind of list of blood types and willing donors. Dad had left early this morning, not long after Helen got in. Down at Mum's grave, probably, the stone by the river. Mum had always loved that spot. It was already a month since she died of her tumour, and Dad was still racked by guilt over it, as if it were somehow his fault, somehow caused by his bringing her here. It made no sense, especially since, as far as Helen remembered, her mother had always been the driving force behind their leaving the datum in the first place. A month, though, which made it more than 6 months since they had all been fired en masse by the federal government. Gosh, Helen thought now, we're still here. Who'd have thought it? They had had to learn fast. They had relied more than they'd realized on various props from the old country. Now they made everything. They knitted, brewed beer, dipped candles, made soap. You could make a good vinegar from pumpkin rind, toothpaste from ground-up charcoal. It helped a lot when Bill Lovell came round selling his new product, miniaturized sets of encyclopedias and copies of Scientific American from pre-1950, full of exploded diagrams of steam engines and practical advice on a whole slew of stuff. They were even rethinking the crops they were growing in the farms and gardens after the vitamin pill supply dried up. And they'd even had a couple of cases of scurvy. Scurvy! And they helped each other out. I fetch water for you while your little one's ill. You feed my chickens when I'm away up country. There was a kind of unwritten price for everything, recorded as favours, a loosely defined currency based on service and barter and promissory notes. Mom would probably have loved the theory of it all, an emerging, self-organizing local economy. Despite dire warnings from some about what would happen when the theoretical protection of the Dayton government had been lifted, they hadn't suddenly been overwhelmed by armies of bandits. Oh, there had been problems, for instance the waves of new colonists who sporadically walked out from the Datum or the Low Earths and tried to settle in Reboot's country. Legally, it was a tricky situation, since such claims, as the Reboot colonists did have, were lodged with a Datum federal government which showed no interest in them anymore. But the mayor in New Scarsdale was usually able to buy the newcomers off by signing bits of paper granting them land 50 or 100 worlds further up west, a deal lubricated with fistfuls of vouchers for drinks in the tavern. There was always room, so much room up here, that almost any problem like that could be resolved. Of course, there was a steady drizzle of thefts of food from the fields, even in this age of stepping from within houses. Mostly you turned a blind eye. Things got more serious when a boy called Doug Collinson was caught red-handed taking beta blockers from Melissa Harris's medicine chest, prescribed for her mild heart condition. Doug didn't need them himself. He was just going to sell them someplace else. Decent drugs were among the most precious commodities they had. Well, Melissa caught him, and she had the presence of mind to swing her stick and smash his stepper so he couldn't get away before the neighbours came running in. Right now, Doug was in confinement in somebody's cellar, while the adults debated what to do about it. Slowly, out of the need to react to such incidents, a framework for maintaining law and order was emerging, maybe ultimately based on some kind of court shared with communities like New Scarsdale in the neighbouring worlds. The framework of Helen's own life was slowly emerging too. Dad constantly pointed out that Helen was 16 years old now and needed to choose a path in life. Well, fine. There was her midwifery, and she was thinking of specializing in medicines, herbs and stuff. A lot of the plants and fungi they found on Earth West 101,754 weren't familiar from Datum Earth. She could become an itinerant seller, or maybe a tutor, a guru, taking her arts and wares and unique flora across the worlds. Or not. She thought she'd find her way. They weren't in paradise. The Long Earth was a big arena where you could feel lost, and you could lose yourself. But maybe all this room was going to be the ultimate gift of the Long Earth to mankind. Room that gave everyone the chance to live as they liked. Helen had decided she liked the happy compromise they were figuring out in Reboot. Well, not long after that, along had come Joshua Valiente, returning from the far stepwise west, towing a defunct airship and trading the romance of the High Megas, and, yes, with Sally Lindsay at his side. Helen, then 17 years old, had had her world turned upside down. Soon she'd moved away with Joshua and married him, and now here they were building another fine young community. The Datum government, meanwhile, had reached out to its scattered colonies once more and gathered them into the embrace of its aegis. Suddenly everybody had to pay taxes. Jack Green, who had been enraged by the letter and the cut-off, was, if anything, even more enraged by the imposition of the aegis. Without her mother, Helen believed, he was filling an empty life with politics. And then Sally showed up again, and once more, Joshua was distracted. The night before they were due to leave on the train for Valhalla, with their bags all packed, Helen couldn't sleep. She went out onto their veranda, into air that was warm for March on this chilly earth. She looked at the twain, still waiting at anchor in the sky over the town, its running lights like a model galaxy. She murmured, "We were young, we were merry, we were very, very wise." Joshua came out to find her. He folded his strong arms around her waist and nuzzled her neck. "What's that, honey?"
"Oh, an old poem by a Victorian poet called Mary Elizabeth Coleridge. I helped Bob Johansson teach it to the 8th graders the other day. We were young, we were merry, we were very, very wise, and the door stood open at our feast, when there passed us a woman with the west in her eyes, and a man with his back to the east." Isn't that haunting?
"You won't lose me, to west or east, I promise."
She found she couldn't reply. Chapter 6. Nelson Azikiwe, or the Reverend Nelson, as his congregation called him in church, or Rev, as they called him down the pub, watched as Ken the shepherd grabbed a pregnant ewe and slung it over his shoulder. To Nelson, this was an astounding display of strength. Ken's ewes were no lightweights. Then Ken walked forward towards a hedgerow, and took another step, and completely vanished, and reappeared a few seconds later, wiped his hands with a none-too-clean towel, and said,
"That'll do for now. There's still a few wolves that haven't gotten a message yet. Suppose I'd better get Tad to draw me another 1,000 yards of electric fence. Don't you want to come and see, Rev? You'll be surprised at how much we've done. Just a step away, you know."
Nelson hesitated. He hated the nausea that came with stepping. They said that after a while you hardly noticed, and maybe so, at least for some. But for Nelson, every step was a penance. But it paid to be neighbourly. After all, it had been a long time since breakfast, and with luck he might get away with a few dry heaves. So he fingered the stepper switch in his pocket, clapped his handkerchief over his mouth. When he'd recovered somewhat, the first thing he noticed in this England one step away from home was not the painstakingly cleared field of grass at his feet, but the trees of the remnant forest beyond Ken's dry stone wall. Big trees, old trees, giants. Some were fallen, their trunks bright with moulds and fungi, and to a clergyman that could have been the spark for a nice little inspirational sermon on the mighty and the futility of their ambitions. But Nelson, in his late 40s now, wasn't planning to be a clergyman for much longer. The light seemed to be a little more golden than it was pre-step, and he glanced up at the sun, which seemed to be in the right place this March day, more or less. Though time on the various earths seemed to flow at the same rate, and the events that defined the calendar, sunrise and sunset, the seasons, seemed synchronized from world to world, according to last week's Nature, some of the new Earth did not appear to tick exactly to the same clock, sometimes leading or following their immediate neighbors by a fraction of a second, as you could prove by such means as very precise astronomical observations, like the occultation of stars by the moon. The discrepancies were minute, but real. Nelson could think of no plausible explanation for this. Nobody knew how or why this phenomenon happened, but as yet, nobody was researching it, because it was just one of a multitude of puzzles generated by the multiple worlds. How strange. How eerie. Of course, he had stopped thinking like a priest, having perhaps shamefully reverted to his ground state of being, a scientist. But still, people all over the world, including some of his own flock, had for a quarter of a century now been abandoning their homes and packing up their kids and buggering off into this great hall of worlds called the Long Earth. And yet nobody knew how it worked, even on the most basic level of how time flowed, or how all those worlds had got there, and still less, what they were for. How was a priest supposed to react to that? Which was, indirectly anyhow, the reason for Nelson's current inner turmoil. Fortunately for the goats and the gravid sheep around him, and for Joy, the young sheepdog Ken was training, they did not have to lie awake at night wondering about this sort of thing. Having given him their usual slotted glances, the animals ambled away, the sheep eating the grass, the goats devouring just about everything else. Shepherd Ken had told him how the whole Long Earth deal worked for the likes of him. In England West and East 1 and 2, the farmers had been clearing forested land on a scale not seen since the Stone Age, and they had had to relearn how to do it. First, you cut down a lot of trees, being careful to put the timber to good use, and then you set loose the animals, either bred here or carried over as young from the datum, one by one. Any hopeful saplings would succumb to the onslaught of the sheep and goats, forestalling the return of the forest. And in time, the grass would come. Clever stuff, grass, Ken liked to say. A plant that actually thrived on being eaten down to the ground. Nelson had rather misjudged Ken when he had first met this sun-tanned, rugged, rather taciturn man, a local whose ancestors had lived on these hills since there were such things as ancestors. It was only by chance that he found out that Ken had been a lecturer at the University of Bath until, like many others, shortly after Step Day, he re-evaluated his lifestyle and his future, which turned out, in his case, to be this farm, just one step away from the datum. In that, Ken was typical of his nation, in a way. The British experience of the Long Earth had been, in the beginning, mostly a painful one. Such had been the early exodus from these crowded islands, particularly from the battered industrial cities of the North, Wales and Scotland, regions isolated from the increasingly complacent city-state that was London, that a rapid population loss had led to an economic crash, even a collapse of the currency, briefly. They had called it the Great Bog-Off. But then the stepwise Britons had begun their own economic growth, and there had been a second wave of emigration, more cautious, hard-headed and industrious. By now there were whole new industrial revolutions going on in the Low Earths. The British seemed to have the building of steam engines and railways in their genes. Some of that hard-acquired wealth had already started to flow back into the datum. In the long run, in their exploration and colonization of the Long Earth, the British had proved to be thorough, patient, careful, and ultimately pretty successful. Just like Ken. But now Nelson had his own journey to make. They spent some time discussing the vigour and health of Ken's flock. Then Nelson cleared his throat and said,
"You know, Ken, I've loved my time here in the parish. There's been a kind of peacefulness, a sense that although the surface of things changes, the soul of them does not. Do you know what I mean?"
Said Ken.
"When I first came here, I walked the hills. There are signs of people having lived here forever, since before England was England. In the graveyard and on the war memorial, I found family names repeated across hundreds of years. Sometimes a man went away to fight for a king he didn't know, in a place he'd never heard of. Sometimes he didn't come back at all. And yet the land endured, you know? Even as this countryside, remote from the urban centres, has survived more or less intact through the great convulsions since Step Day. It must have been very hard for such men to leave such a place. Just as it will be for me.
You, Rav?
You are the first to know. I have had a word with the bishop, and he has agreed that I can move out just as soon as my successor is in place. He looked out over the flocks. Look at them. They graze as if they will graze for eternity, and are content with that.
But you're no sheep, Rev.
Quite so. The fact is, I spend a lot of my life being a scientist, and am obligated to a different covenant than the one I bow to at the moment, although I must say that in my head the two have rather melded together. In short, I need to find a new purpose, one more suited to my talents and my background, if you'll pardon my immodesty.
You've pardoned me for worse, Rev.
Perhaps, perhaps not. Now, if you're done here, let me stand you a pint down the pub. And then I have some calls to make.
Ken said,
Oh, that's nice. About the pint, I mean.
He whistled.
Joy! Here, girl!
The dog came bounding up, tail wagging, and leapt into Ken's strong arms, just as she'd been trained, so she could be carried back to the datum. She was a dog whose supper bowl was currently lodged in a different corner of the multiverse entirely, but who had no concern about that, as long as her master whistled for her. Chapter 7 Telling Ken a bit of news like that was as good as hiring a skywriter, Nelson knew. Well, what was done was done. Once back at the rectory, Nelson made a few follow-up calls, disclosing, apologizing, accepting congratulations. Then, with relief, he told his computer to boot up, lean back in his office chair, and watch the multiple screens light up.
Search terms. 1. The return of the airship the Mark Twain. 2. The Lobsang Project. Supplementary. SOC media streams for last 24 hours. Slanting towards current concerns. Depth 3. Occam's Razor.
Bandwidth here was generally dreadful, but not for Nelson. A man with a past like his, he'd once worked for the Black Corporation itself, if only indirectly, had a great many contacts in many useful places. Favour speaks under favour. Only last year a black helicopter had landed just short of the graveyard, and the team of technicians that stepped out onto the glebe had left him with access to as much satellite traffic as he wanted, including some channels known to very few people indeed, and, moreover, the means to decipher those channels. When he'd done with the latest SOC media chit-chat, he left his study for the kitchen. A search like the one he'd just initiated was never going to be quick, and while his software agents were scuttling across the web, he warmed up a microwave curry. And he reflected, as he often did, about the previous inhabitants of this parsonage. The equipment in his study, his phone, laptop, tablets, was all state-of-the-art, more or less, though it would mostly have been familiar to users of 10 or 20 years ago. This was an argument seized on by some critics of the long Earth migration. Need exerted a necessary pressure on humanity. You had to be hungry to innovate, and you needed to be surrounded by competitors to be driven to achieve. And in the long Earth, with bellies filled too easily and plenty of space to spread out into, invention had stalled. Still, none of Nelson's predecessors here, not even the most recent, had had access to anything like the technology at his fingertips now, retro or not. And every single one of them had been unable, just like Nelson, to make the antique toilet work properly. He liked that reflection. It helped keep him down to earth. The cooking done, he returned to his study. The Lobsang search was still in progress, and as he ate, he logged into the Quizmasters. This was a little-known chat room, access to which would only be vouchsafed to you by invitation, and the invitation was a series of tests.
Nelson, intrigued by a quiz he'd been sent without explanation, had completed it after evensong one day a few weeks ago. It took him 27 minutes. His reward was to be sent another quiz of similarly fiendish intricacy. Over the following days, more quizzes turned up randomly. Nelson had been impressed by the questions, which demanded not only knowledge in a vast number of fields, but also the ability to make use of that knowledge against the clock, while drawing on a multiplicity of disciplines, including undisciplines. In the nerdosphere, in pursuit of the elusive and the strange, the strongest intellect, Nelson knew, was good for nothing without a propensity for pack-rat fact accumulation, an appreciation of serendipity, and an endless interest in the incongruous, the out of place. And that was what the quizmaster's test seemed to select for. The room had opened for him on the seventh day. That was the first time he'd learned the group's name for itself. Initially, the quizmaster seemed like any other chat room, except that everybody in it knew that in some way they had been chosen, which gave a frisson to the proceedings. A self-selecting elite of the nerdosphere, and very useful, he'd found, if directed to a task. But time and again, conversations in that room came round to the monopoly known as the Black Corporation, which was for the most part detested by the Circle members, that itself being a puzzle, of course. When Nelson went online, or more accurately, onlines, he mixed in cyberspace with a lot of people who had a marked dislike of black helicopters, governments, washing more than once a week, and above all, secrets. And, just to top it off, particularly didn't like the Black Corporation. Which was kind of strange if you thought about it, since the infrastructure of the nerdosphere itself nowadays was more or less supported by black products. Certainly the nerdosphere was always full of speculation, scuttlebutt, and downright lies about what was happening in the most ultra-secret laboratories of the organization. Yes, everybody knew Black's story, the elements of which had become as familiar, it sometimes seemed to Nelson, as the Nativity. It was a classic American narrative of its kind. It had all started when Douglas Black and his associates had set up just another computer company, with the help of Black's late grandfather's oil money bequest. This was the early 1990s. Black had only been in his mid-20s. From the beginning, Black's lines had included such much-longed-for-by-customers' products as computers with long battery power and fault-free software, machines that were your partners, not just a gadget for extracting money from you, not just an ad for some superior future version of themselves. Machines that seemed mature. And, from the beginning, Black had begun to make philanthropic donations of various kinds around the world, including a scholarship program in South Africa that Nelson himself had benefited from. With time, the Black product line went from strength to strength and began to innovate significantly. Black was entitled to rewards aplenty for his intellectual courage as far as Nelson was concerned. He was, after all, the founder of the first serendipital laboratory. The logic was that since so many important new discoveries in science were made by accident, then the process would be speeded up if you set up a situation in which a very large number of accidents happened, and watched the results carefully. According to legend, Black had even deliberately employed people who didn't quite know what they were doing, or had a bad memory, or who were known to be congenitally unlucky and careless. It was, of course, a lunatic idea. Black did take some precautions, such as building his laboratory to the same safety standards as were employed by explosives manufacturers. Black's innovations had won him huge sales, public praise, and a concerted attack by instant enemies. The established companies he was wrong-footing and whose profits he was trashing accused him of everything from monopolistic practices to a lack of patriotism. The public didn't buy any of these lies, it seemed, but it did keep on buying Black's neat stuff. And indeed the public bought into Black himself, who became a hero, a cheerful rogue, thumbing his nose at older, lumbering companies, investing in spectacular super-rich indulgences like homes under the sea and jaunts into orbit, while sprinkling charities and good causes with staggering amounts of money. Then the gods truly smiled on Black's project, when an experiment to find a new type of surgical plaster was left too long in the sunshine and turned into gel, as it became known, a curious quasi-organic matter embedded with self-designing, self-repairing bioneural circuitry, smart enough to morph itself physically to fit the circumstances it found itself in. The newspapers called it the intelligent bandage after its first applications, but it had soon proved to be much more than that, and much smarter. As a self-correcting, self-repairing, physically malleable data and processing store, gel, in all its forms, had become the mainstay of the Black Corporation's output. There was a wave of new products, and indeed, new types of product. This time, many of Black's competitors were wiped out completely. Now it was the turn of governments to become suspicious. Black was simply too rich, too powerful, not to mention too generous and too popular, to be born. The US administration made attempts to take control of Black's operations under various national interest fig leaves, or at least to break up his empire. Eminent Domain was quoted, "Militarization of Black's enterprises was attempted, but Black hastily diversified into obviously non-security, non-military applications, such as medicine. Suddenly the corporation turned its attention to the disadvantaged, to letting the dumb speak and the lame walk. Nowadays there were people seeing, hearing, walking, running, swimming, even juggling, thanks to the prosthetic aids, implants and other products developed by the Black Corporation and its subsidiaries. With such a portfolio behind him, Black was able to argue that there was no national interest served in the government's pursuit of him. Its actions were anti-capitalist, whisper it quietly, socialist. Since then, Black had made an even grander gesture when, nearly a decade ago, he had more or less gifted Twain technology through an international consortium of manufacturers to the UN, governments worldwide, and the peoples of the New Earths. Nowadays, the Twains that plied the US Aegis, even the few police and military craft, as well as the commercial fleets, were all Black Corporation products, built at cost. Not only that, the conglomerate dispersed even vaster funds to good causes, and Black became even more of a hero. Despite all this, however, the name of Douglas Black was anathema to many in the chat rooms. Nelson had searched in vain for plausible reasons, and found none. It wasn't as if many of those who poured out their bile could have any personal grudge. None of them, for example, had been executives of the moribund companies whose careers might have been ruined by Black's rise. It seemed the worst you could say about Douglas Black as a human being was that he was a workaholic who worked hard and expected people to work hard for him. Maybe this had cost him, even significantly. There had been an online legend that Black's Serendipity Lab was even behind the stepper box that had opened up the Long Earth. Somehow Black had pissed off the inventor, and in the end, the box design had been dumped into the public domain, galvanizing all mankind, but earning not a penny for anybody, not directly at any rate. That was all behind the scenes, and yet Black was hated by some. The minds hiding behind the various pseudonyms Nelson found himself staring at among the quizmasters were not stupid. They could not be, given the high bar set for entrance in the first place. Indeed, it sometimes felt as if a membership of Mensa might just about qualify you to make the coffee for this particular metaphorical caffeeklatch. Not stupid, no. But Nelson had met many people in different walks of life, and he thought he could read at least some of them. These men and women were bright, truly bright. But in some, even through the impersonal medium of the chat rooms, he sensed something dark and hidden, sometimes betrayed by the occasional comment or curious turn of phrase. Envy, to start with. Paranoid suspicion, for another. A kind of seam of malevolence, a capacity for cold hatred, a capacity that needed an outlet, any outlet. A man like Black, who presented a public face, who could seem either an object of envy or too good to be true and therefore deserving of suspicion, was an ideal target.
This didn't show itself often, no, but it was apparent to those who really watched other people. And especially to a man who had grown up a black kid in South Africa and had not forgotten the experience. Anyhow, whatever you thought about black, Nelson did like the Black Corporation in all its wonderful and manifold manifestations, and in particular, he liked the mysteries their various activities threw up for him to ponder over. For example, as he had drifted somewhat aimlessly through the periphery of the information cloud that surrounded Black, he had started to notice how often the Lobsang project was mentioned. But it was always a dead end in any search, a link to nowhere. Lobsang. Of course, the name meant big brain in Tibetan, which showed that somebody in the Black Corporation had not only a sense of humour, but also some skills when it came to languages. But Lobsang was a personal name too, and slowly Nelson had come to envisage Lobsang as a person to be tracked down, him and his project. And now Nelson, all alone in this rather chilly rectory, with all 8 screens, windows to the world, smiled. For suddenly, his search had borne fruit. One of his screens filled up with an image of the airship Mark Twain, rather battle-worn after its now famous journey, being towed into what remained of Madison, Wisconsin, after the nuke attack 10 years back. Towed by Joshua Valiente and a young woman whom no one, to Nelson's knowledge, had subsequently been able to identify. Nelson was pretty sure that he'd seen just about everything that Joshua Valiente had brought back from the extraordinary voyage of the Mark Twain. The Black Corporation, in a gesture typical of Douglas Black, had dumped Godzilla bytes of data from the voyage into the archive of any university that wanted it, for open public access and study. Godzilla bytes. Nelson had an irrational dislike of petabytes, the recognized term for a particular and particularly large wadge of data. Anything that sounded like a kitten's gentle nip just didn't have the moxie to do the job asked of it. Godzilla bytes, on the other hand, shouted to the world that it was dealing with something very, very big, and possibly dangerous. Nelson had seen this particular clip, or variants of it, from other camera angles many times before, and he wondered why his search engines had thrown it up now. Watching, he saw that this bit of hasty amateur footage showed a scene where Valiente, in a radiation exposure processing camp in West 1, seemed to be carrying a cat under one arm. Some bystander off-screen burst out laughing and called, "What's that, the ship's cat?" And somebody else, almost certainly Valiente's unknown companion, though she was out of shot, called back, "Yeah, wise ass, and I can speak Tibetan." You had to listen very carefully to make out this piece of nonsense, but that word was evidently what the search had picked on. Tibetan. A subsidiary search tag from Lobsang had brought this fragment of the complicated saga of the Mark Twain drifting to the surface for his attention. What had the woman meant? Why use such a word, Tibetan, if it wasn't somehow relevant? He had no idea yet where this was leading. But now he had a link between one of Black's more high-profile projects, the Twain and its journey, and one of the most low-profile, Lobsang, embodied in that single word. Of course, the complete absence of any other link was itself suspicious. For now, the search was going no further. He was covering what he already knew. Nelson yawned, blinked, and shut down the screens. There was a mystery here, he was sure, and he felt a tingle of anticipation at the prospect of following this trail further. And this was precisely why he was shedding his parochial duties, to have the time, while he had the resources and the strength, to follow such trails, wherever they led him. But of course the overarching mystery that obsessed him in a background kind of way was the conundrum of stepping itself, of the sudden discovery of the long earth, into which Joshua Valiente and his airship and his loudmouth partner and, apparently, his Tibetan-speaking cat had wandered so famously, of the utter realignment of the cosmos in Nelson's own lifetime. How could he not be intrigued? What could it all mean for mankind, the future, indeed for God? How could he not pursue such questions? Well, the best strategy was usually to tackle smaller mysteries first. And right now, in that spirit, before getting ready for bed, he put on an apron, grabbed one of his toolboxes, and walked to the stone-floored toilet. This throne was a massive edifice that even included straining bars, and would have been a wonderful asset if anybody over the years could have made it work properly, whereas now it worked in various forms of improperly. He had vowed to get the thing functioning before his tenure was over, taking especial care to find out why it always backed up during an east wind. On the whole, he thought, as he knelt before the cracked china sculpture, as if before a pagan idol, it was amazing what the English put up with. Chapter 8. So the Valiente family travelled to the high mega city of Valhalla to catch a long-haul twain to Datum Earth. The twain journey, across less than 3,000 Earths, took only a few hours. At Valhalla, Thomas Kayangu was waiting to greet them, with a big handwritten sign, Valiente. Another old buddy of Joshua's, Thomas was around 50, with long black hair pinned back in a ponytail and a wide grin splitting a dark, reasonably handsome face. His accent was thick Australian.
"Greetings, Clan Valiente. Welcome to Earth West 1,400,000. Well, officially it's 1.4 million plus 13, since our founding fathers were stoned when they first got here and lost count, but we like to round it down for the TV ads. Good to see you again, Joshua."
Joshua grinned and shook his hand. Thomas dived in to help with their bags. Getting their bearings, some of them a little woozy from the step nausea medication, they stood on a concrete apron under the swollen hull of the airship. Joshua, Helen, Dan, and Bill Chambers, with their baggage accumulating at their feet. They and the other disembarking passengers were lost in the expanse of this apron, Joshua thought. And beyond sprawled the city of Valhalla itself, clusters of heavy buildings under a blue sky, faintly tinged with smog, with a din of traffic and construction engines clanking and roaring. The air was warm, warmer than at hell knows where, but still, behind the hot tar and oil aroma of this brand new city, Joshua could smell the salt of the nearby inland American Sea, just as he remembered from his first visit to these worlds 10 years ago. A huge form swept over their heads, with a drone of engines and a wash of displaced air. A twain, a big one, a freight vessel heading for the transit routes to the Low Earths and the Datum. Valhalla's principal function was as a transport nexus, one terminus of the river of airship traffic that flowed endlessly across more than a million Earths, to the Datum and back again, carrying freight and passengers. And it was no coincidence that Valhalla had grown up on a location that in most stepwise Americas lay close to what in Datum terms was the Mississippi. The twains took you across the worlds, while the river could carry your goods across a world. Daniel Rodney Valiente, 8 years old, had never seen ships of such a size, and he jumped up and down, thrilled.
"Are we going to ride in one of those things, Dad?"
"In a little while, son."
"And here comes Sally Lindsay," Helen said. "Surprise, surprise."
"Give her a break," Joshua murmured to Helen. "I did arrange to meet her here."
Sally was wearing her usual pioneer-type gear, her signature fisherman's jacket with 1,000 pockets, and she carried a light leather pack.
"What a racket," she said as she walked up, theatrically clamping her hands over her ears. "Noise everywhere you go. We ought to call ourselves Homo Clamorans, noise-making man."
Helen just looked at her, unsmiling.
"Travelling with us, are you? The Great Wanderer hitching a ride on a commercial twain?"
"Well, we're all going the same way. Why not get reacquainted? We can swap recipes for ice cream."
Joshua grabbed his wife's arm in case she felt like throwing a punch. It wouldn't have been the first time. As he watched this byplay, Thomas's grin was becoming a little more fixed.
"Right, I'm sensing a little tension here."
Bill murmured, "It's complicated. Don't ask." Sally snapped, "Who's this character?" He's called Thomas Kayangu, Joshua said. An old friend of mine.
You don't know me, Miss Lindsay, but I know of you, through Joshua.
Oh, God, a fanboy. Helen stepped forward. And we still haven't been properly introduced, Mr. Kayangu. My name's Helen Valiente, née Green.
The wife, of course.
Thomas shook her hand.
The wife?
Sally laughed.
You have all your bags? I have a buggy just over there. Joshua sent a message ahead. I booked you all a hotel in downtown 4.
As they walked over the apron through a dispersing crowd of passengers, Thomas said,
You can't blame a Val Allen for following Joshua's exploits, Miss Lindsay.
He's a married man, Helen said sturdily. There'll be no more exploits if I have anything to do with it.
Yeah, but he did discover this Valhalla belt itself during the journey. A band of North Americas with generous inland oceans, ripe for colonization.
Discover? Sally snapped back. I was there already, as I recall. They reached Thomas's buggy, a low, open electric engine vehicle with 8 plastic seats.
Please, jump in.
The cart pulled away, heading south.
Thomas and I are old buddies, Joshua said to Sally, by way of explanation or peacekeeping.
You mean he's a long-term stalker? Sally said.
We met up out in the High Megas years ago. We were both on sabbatical, though Thomas calls it going walkabout. We're like minds, kind of. Knowing he was here in Valhalla, I asked him to help us out.
Helen said, Well, thank you, Mr. Kayangu. But what do you do the rest of the time?
Look at him, Sally said. Can't you tell? Look at the way he's dressed. He's a comber, a professional drifter.
More or less,
Thomas called over his shoulder as he drove.
I grew up in Australia, and I've always been fascinated by comers. Many of my family's people went off to become comers themselves, you know, in stepwise versions of Oz. And I'm intrigued by natural steppers, like you, like Joshua, the whole phenomenon. Though I'm not one myself. I'm also interested in the whole question of how human civilization is going to be shaped by the long Earth. I mean, it's still only a single generation since Step Day. We're only at the beginning. I had a hand in the concept design of Valhalla, of the city itself.
Sally snorted. Concept design. Thomas was unperturbed.
The purest way of life in the long Earth is the coma. A solitary individual, or well, maybe a family, a small cohesive group, just wandering, picking the lowest hanging fruits. The long Earth is so rich, there's no need to do anything else. But the point of Valhalla is that it's a city, a genuine city with all the essential attributes of a datum community, but sustained by comas.
They were entering a more built-up area now, Joshua saw. He glimpsed a sign. Downtown 4. The buildings of brick, concrete or timber were low, squat, massively constructed, and set out in sprawling empty plots. Typical colony world architecture. If this was a downtown, it was definitely a high megas downtown, full of room, with more of the feel of a suburban mall back on the Dayton. There were few vehicles on the wide roads, most of them horse-drawn, and few pedestrians to be seen, with most of them wearing steppers. This wasn't a place you stayed put in for long. But it was evidently a city in political ferment. Some of those big blank walls were adorned with posters and graffiti.
Support the Footprint Congress, no to datum taxes, and down with Cowley the genocide.
Thomas was still talking about comas and cities.
I've written a book on the subject, he said now. Comas and a New Theory of Civilization.
Helen frowned. A book? Nobody reads books now, or at least not new books. Thomas, steering one-handed, tapped his forehead.
All in here. I travel the worlds and give readings.
A regular Johnny Shakespeare, Sally said dismissively. The cart pulled up outside a 4-story building with an expansive street-level frontage. Thomas said,
Here you go. The Hill Drum, the best hotel in Valhalla. You're in there for 3 weeks if you need it.
Sally scowled. How long? Why?
We've only come here to catch a twain down to the datum.
Joshua said gently, Sally, Helen and I are here to look at a school for Dan. Dan's little jaw dropped.
You're sending me here? To school?
Helen glared at Joshua.
Great way to break the news.
Sorry. She patted Dan's arm.
Valhalla's schools have got a reputation as the best in the high megas, Dan. It would be fun, and you'd learn so much new stuff. Things you could never learn at hell knows where. But if you don't want to be away from home...
Dan scowled.
I'm not a little kid, Mom. Can I learn to be a twain driver here?
Joshua laughed and tousled his hair.
You can be anything you want, kiddo. That's the point.
Helen said to Sally, Also, I need to see my father. Thomas nodded.
Jack Green, fast becoming another hero, a founder of the Children of Freedom movement, now an organizer of the Footprint Congress, which has attracted delegates from thousands of inhabited Americas.
He's fast becoming a major embarrassment is what he is, Helen said sternly.
This hanging around wasn't part of the deal, Sally snapped at Joshua. Why didn't you tell me?
Joshua shrugged.
Well, you didn't wait to be consulted. Besides, how would you have reacted? Just like this, right?
Sally picked up her pack.
I'm out of here.
She disappeared with a pop of displaced air. Thomas sighed.
What a woman! I hope I have a chance to get her autograph. Come on, let's get you checked in.
Chapter 9 In the morning, Bill went off for a bit of an old explore on my own, as he put it. Joshua made sure he had a cell phone so he could call for a ride back if he got incapable. Bill had gone by the time Thomas showed up to give Joshua, Helen and Dan a lift to Dan's prospective school. This was in a different urban hub called Downtown 7, on the other side of this intricately designed city, so they climbed into Thomas's buggy once more and set off across town. The city had grown hugely since the last time Joshua had seen it. Valhalla, starting from a clean slate, was always intended to be more than just another city. It looked attractively different, even in its basic layout, built on hexagonal plots that were spreading around the southern shore of the American Sea of this world, and cutting into the native forest. Many of the houses glittered with solar paint, but others had grass and other plants growing thick on their roofs, a natural thatch. And wherever the view opened up to the north, Joshua glimpsed the sea, a flat, silver horizon. The coastline lay at about the same latitude as Dayton, Chicago. At the shore, the city took on an older feel to Joshua's eyes, an echo of an antique America, a maritime past. There was a respectable port now, mostly wooden buildings, warehouses and boatyards, even what looked like a fisherman's chapel. He supposed the chapel would already have its memorial stones to those lost in this version of the American Sea. Stones without graves, stones with no bones beneath. Further out, there were wharves and jetties and moles. On the sea itself, there were ships, grey shadows, some mechanically driven, mostly coal-burning probably, but many were sailing ships like reconstructions, museum pieces. Sailors were working this new ocean, fishing, trapping. They hunted tremendous reptilian swimmers, something like plesiosaurs, and adorned their boats with their giant jaws and vertebrae. Like the whalers of the 18th and 19th centuries back on the datum, these seafarers were studying their worlds with an intensity that outshone the more scientific explorers, and were linking together the scattered, growing communities around the shores of these stepwise American oceans. They weren't whalers, for there were no whales here. But Joshua thought he would try to make time to explore all this with Dan, and they could talk about Moby Dick. And whenever they glimpsed the city's landward edge, the party saw something much stranger in its mundane way. The outer suburbs, thick with factories and forges, just ended, terminating in cut-back forest or partially drained swamp and marsh. There wasn't a field anywhere. No cattle grazing, not a blade of cultivated grass outside the city boundary.
This was a city without a hinterland of farmers. Joshua knew the theory of Valhalla. It was part of this generation's response to the challenge of the endless spaces of the long Earth. On Step Day, mankind, or most of it, those unlike Sally and her family, who had known it all already, had begun to spread out across an extended Earth that had a diameter of 8,000 miles and a surface area that made a Dyson sphere look like a ping-pong ball. How they lived out there depended on preference, education, and instinct. Some dashed back and forth between the datum and the low Earths, looking for a little more room, a way to make a little more money. Some, like Helen's family, the Greens, had gone trekking out into the stepwise wilderness and had begun to build new communities, the story of colonial-era America rerun across an infinite frontier. And some just wandered off, helping themselves to the inexhaustible riches of the long Earth, Thomas's Comas. All of which was fine, until the day you needed root canal dentistry, or your e-book reader broke down, or you worried whether your kids were ever going to learn anything more than how to plow a field or trap a rabbit, or you got sick of the mosquitoes, or, damn it, you just wanted to go shopping. Some people drifted back to the datum, or the crowded low Earths. Valhalla was another response, a brand new city growing out in the high megas, the remote long Earth, but deriving from long Earth lifestyles, that is, supported by Comas, not farmers. There had been precursors in human history across datum Earth. Given time and a rich environment, hunter-gatherer populations could achieve huge feats and develop complex societies. At Watson Brake, Louisiana, 5,000 years in the past, nomadic Native American hunter-gatherers had constructed major earthwork complexes. Valhalla had just taken this to a new, modern, more consciously designed level. As it happened, the theory of the city was the first topic Jacques Montcute, the school's headmaster, chose to talk about when he brought Dan and his family into his office for an introductory chat.
"The central ethos of Valhalla is balance," Montcute said. Aged about 30, slender, slightly severe, he had an accent that Joshua might have pegged as French, but with a naggingly familiar overlay. His name rang a bell too, Montcute. There was one other child here, aside from Dan, a dark, unsmiling girl of about 15 called Roberta Golding. "Most of our adult citizens chose to leave the old world, to leave the old ways behind. They want some of what a city can give, but they didn't come out into the long Earth to break their backs farming or to live in some slum suburb in order to serve the city's needs. But here we are, maintaining city life without all that." He smiled encouragingly at Dan. "Can you see how we make a living without farmers to grow our food for us?" Dan shrugged his slim shoulders. "Maybe you're all robbers." Helen sighed. Roberta Golding spoke for the first time since being introduced.
"Valhalla is a city supported by Comas, hunter-gatherers. The logic is elementary. Intensive farming can support orders of magnitude, more people per acre, than hunting and gathering. On a single world, a Coma community, even if natural resources are rich, would necessarily be spread out, diffuse. The concentration of population needed to sustain a city would be impossible. Here it is sufficient for the Comas to be spread out, not geographically, but over many stepwise Earths, over 100 parallel Valhallas, left wild for the hunting." She made a sandwich of her hands, pressing. "The city is the product of a layer of worlds, each lightly harvested, rather than the product of a single intensively farmed world. This is intensive gathering, a uniquely post-stepping urban solution." Joshua thought the kid spoke like a textbook.
"You've been reading up," said Helen, as if accusing her of cheating.
"Very good, Roberta," said Montcute. "I mean, it also helps that we live in such a rich location geographically, by the shore of a fecund sea."
Joshua snapped his fingers.
"Happy Landings, that's it. You're from Happy Landings,
Both of you, right? You, Mr. Montcute, I recognize your accent and your name. I may have met your grandmother once.
He looked a little uncomfortable, but he smiled.
Kitty, actually my great-grandmother. She always remembered running into you, Mr. Valiente, all those years ago. Yes, I'm from Happy Landings, as it's become known.